This is the Tan Report. I'm your host, Han Trung. My guest on the podcast this week often deals with some heavy issues. Oncology is a serious line of work, so you may think an oncologist would be equally serious in their demeanor. That's not quite the case with this doctor. Before I drove to Covington, Louisiana to interview him, I had to call him to set up when and where. I got his voicemail. Here's his outgoing message.
You reached the pirate oncologist. If you be a patient, call 985-92909. And one of your mates will be right with you. The rest of these scallywags, leave a message after the beep.
That was my introduction to the self-proclaimed pirate oncologist.
My name is Jay Sox. I'm from Louisiana, and I've been in this area just about my entire life. I'm a medical oncologist, and I've been working with, either closely with, or actually part of Mary Bird Perkins for about 26 years.
Mary Bird Perkins Cancer Center, according to its website, provides cancer care each year to more patients than any other facility in Louisiana. It's based in Baton Rouge, but has multiple locations, including Covington, where I met Dr. Sox. Our conversation covered a lot of ground. We talked about things like why cancer is particularly deadly in Louisiana, what steps we can take to be more prepared for it, and Dr. Sox's personal cancer journey, which frightened, but also gave him a different perspective on cancer treatment. But one of the first things I wanted to know was the origin of the pirate oncologist. There's actually two versions. You're the pirate oncologist. How did that start?
The pirate oncologist. So I've dressed up as a character since I was a little kid. My sister found a picture of me as a pirate when I was like 3 or 4 years old. So it's been a thing. The rest of the family was dressed in some typical Mardi Gras stuff, and I'm a pirate. So I don't know if that story came out or if it was just the infusion center nurses where we give the chemotherapy every Halloween. They like to have a theme dress up, and they picked pirate this one year. And so I went to Party City and got some pirate stuff in addition to a few little things I had at home at the time. And they were like, oh my God, you are a pirate. And so ever since then, the pirate theme has kind of been a thing. But I have multiple costumes and versions of pirate that I do all year long. Patients will request something. Hey, look, I'm finishing my treatment. Can you dress up as a pink fairy or whatever? And now I've amassed a ridiculous amount of costume accessories.
And since this is a podcast, people can't quite see you. Well, they physically can't see you. Did you have to get a beard for the pirate costume? Because just to let listeners know, you have a full beard. I gotta say, your hair looks kind of pirate-ish.
Yes.
So did you have to kind of get a beard for that, or did you sport this beard?
So then? I was clean cut, military style haircut most of my childhood and even my younger adulthood. In the late 90s, early 2000, I had a little bit of a goatee, and then I had made partner and started to let my hair grow, and I grew a full goatee, and then I just went with a full beard, which is actually kind of short right now because I burned it when I was dyeing it recently, so I had to get it trimmed. But I've had the full beard.
Can we back up, though?
Since mid-2000s.
How did you burn your beard?
With the you have to strip it to color it.
Really?
And the bleach is strong, and the ends of your beard, ends of your hair that are split ends, they just break off when they get bleached.
On the day I met Dr. Sox, his beard had a dash of pink. His fingernails were painted neon green. He was wearing what looked like paisley printed samurai pants, a vest bedazzled with beads and glitter, and an electric blue blazer because it is an office and, you know, you should wear a jacket in this kind of setting. As you heard Dr. Sox mention, he has a ton of costumes, but he's still best known for dressing like a pirate while meeting with cancer patients. He's been doing it for about 10 years. That outgoing pirate voicemail message of his has been on his cell phone for about just as long.
A lot of this is heavy. It's oncology stuff. And it's a little way to lighten things up. And, you know, when a when a doctor calls me or a referring physician, if they're from this area, they know me. It's not a big deal. When they're calling from MD Anderson or Sloan Kettering or something, they're a little bit off balance with it, but they're not turned off by it, really. And many of my patients have my private cell phone number. And when the patients call, I think they're like, oh, he's always a pirate. And then they kind of, I don't know, it distracts from this really heavy situation that they're dealing with. I mean, for me, sometimes dressing up helps me get to work because it's heavy sometimes. You're sitting in a room like my exam room that we're sitting in right now, and you're dealing with some really heavy diagnosis or some bad news, and they're getting it from a guy dressed as a pirate or a clown or just in bright clothes. And it just kind of changes the room a little bit.
Takes off the edge a little?
I think so. It's almost like when I do house calls, which I do. When you go into their house, you're on their turf. They're in control. And when they come here, they're terrified, even if they've been here 100 times, because it's a doctor's office and it's kind of sterile and the lights. And so I have some of my real, you know, medical degrees, but I also have my kindergarten graduation. And then I have some just kind of amusing things that are from my house for people to look at while they're in the waiting room. And then I walk in and I'm in some kind of outlandish clothes.
If you can, give me some context. By the time the patients reach you, do they know they have cancer? Are you the person delivering the news sometimes?
Most of the time, they know. They've had a problem. They've been to their primary doctor. They've had a biopsy. Sometimes their primary doctor will refer them here before anybody goes over the biopsy result. So they know something's up, but they don't know it's cancer. Honestly, getting diagnosed is terrifying. And the period of time from getting diagnosed until you start to do something about it is the worst. The anxiety is super high. And so once they see me, there may be some additional tests that take a little while. And then they come back and I said, okay, we have a plan. And as soon as they have a plan, their anxiety level goes down because they could do something about the problem they have. And, you know, some people have a cancer problem that there's not a lot of good treatment for. But even if there's not, if they just have a plan, their anxiety level goes down. And just trying to live with that level of anxiety 24 hours a day is horrible. I mean, once you get a plan, you're on the road to having treatment or having relief or whatever it is, then there's a sense of relief.
When a patient does get diagnosed and they come to you for a plan, and I'd imagine you've been in certain scenarios and situations where you had to say, look, this is the plan, but this is the realistic outcome. Like, how do you deliver that? Or am I making too many assumptions?
No, you're not making too many assumptions. That happens. And it's happened with really good friends of mine that I know in the community, colleagues that I work with, and they come in and they, a lot of times, if they're also physicians, they know they have a bad diagnosis. But even people who don't have any idea about science or health, so you have to tell them in the terms they can understand what's wrong and why there's no good treatment option or why the treatment option has just a poor success rate and what their life expectancy is going to be. And it's tough. It's a really hard conversation. I tell them, make them communicate back to me so that I know they understand. And then we don't talk about that every single time I see them, because if they've got 6 months or a year to live, why do they need to talk about the fact that they might die tomorrow every single day? I go back to it periodically, but not every time. So sometime they may come in and they're feeling good that day and they're, I mean, you guys need to go to lunch after this or whatever, you know? So you kind of, they have to have an opportunity to grab some joy while they're alive and while they're able, and to just keep harping on you're going to die is not a great, in my mind, not a great way to do it. But most of the visits are concentrating on controlling symptoms and how can we get you more functional so you can go do this or that, or they have some plan coming up. And one of the other things I like to do is, okay, what is your wish? What do you want to do during this time? And, well, you know, my daughter's getting married in May. And okay, well, that's a realistic time frame. let's do whatever we can to get you to May feeling well. And so we have a goal. Now, hopefully May comes and they're great and they keep going past May. But if I can get them to the wedding, that was a goal that they wanted, you know? And for a person who's on the, you know, past 50 end of their life, which is still extraordinarily young, they have grown children maybe, and so those things are happening that they want to participate in. When you get somebody who's really young, those are really difficult. They have those goals, they're different ones, but a lot of times, how much time can I have with my family? Quality time. And some of them want quantity, even if the quality's not quite as good. And so, it's tough.
What's the impact on you? How does that affect you?
It causes me to grow beards and long hair and wear crazy clothes.
That's how you deal with it?
Partly. I have to decompress at the end of the day. And so I go into my, I have a condo downtown Covington's where I live, and it's well outfitted. I just go and sit there. I play music.
What do you play?
Mostly ukulele.
Interesting.
A little bit of guitar. I'm trying to learn drums, play a little bit of piano and clarinet. So, and I have all that set up and I can go home and just jam. I have a lot of friends around that I go hang out with, but usually right after work, I go home and I decompress. Even if I have to come back to the hospital, I'll go home for a little while and then go finish at the hospital.
What keeps you going, though? Because I'd imagine this is, as you mentioned earlier, this is a very heavy issue. You're dealing very much with life and death. And, like, how do you keep yourself motivated as a professional?
The science is amazingly interesting. Honestly, 10, 12 years ago, I was really tired of oncology. Nearly all the drugs we were using make people terribly sick. And a lot of times we weren't real successful with some of the cancers. And it's hard to keep making people sick, you know? I know if I make 100 people sick with this cancer, that 70 of them are going to come out on the other side good. But getting those 100 through is tough. You tell them, you're going to have to do this. It's going to make you ill. But you have a 70% chance that we're going to get rid of this cancer and you're going to have a long life. But you got to go through this hell. And, you know, I say that with all the time, that saying, you know, you're going through hell, keep going. And so, you know, you got to kind of help be a cheerleader and push them through.
Getting through cancer in Louisiana can be more challenging than most places in the U.S. According to Taking Aim at Cancer in Louisiana, or TACL for short, Louisiana is ranked the 7th worst state for cancer outcomes. TACL is an initiative that connects multiple sectors throughout Louisiana with the goal of improving those poor cancer outcomes in the state. It was launched by former Louisiana Governor John Bel Edwards and the former head of the state's Department of Public Health. One of TACL's objectives is to give communities across the state access to cancer screenings. Dr. Sox told me access, or the lack thereof, plays a big role in Louisiana's low ranking for cancer outcomes.
I think a large part of it is access to care.
We're a very poor state.
We're a poor state. We're a state with groups of people that are suspicious of modern medicine. And it doesn't have to even be cancer. It can be high blood pressure treatment or anything. When I lived down the bayou, we did house calls, partly because people couldn't get out, partly because they wouldn't. Family wanted the doctor to come by because they're not going to leave. And the small Cajun communities, some of the older people were still looking for the traitor in their area to come and take care of them. And looking very Cajun, I was easily kind of brought into some of these communities that I was never a part of before. We also have people that don't go for their regular checkups. You know, we have screening tools that are super effective. Mary Bird Perkins has a huge effort in the community, especially underserved areas, for screening for a lot of the common cancers like colon cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, and skin cancers. And so those outreach programs help a lot. Bring people in, you find them, and then Mary Bird has a mechanism of getting them in so you can get them diagnosed and get them treated. A lot of those people would never go to the doctor until things were so far gone, there was very little you could do. And then I also think that we have people that just don't leave. And so our gene pool is more shallow, and we have some cancer genes that are just there. And they're not leaving because we don't have people coming in and going out. And so we've concentrated that. And then we're at the bottom of the largest river on the continent, and we're just surrounded by toxins that increase our risk. We have a poor community, ill-informed community, a lot of cigarette smoking still here, which is one of the biggest. We have a lot of obesity problems, which is another huge risk factor for cancer.
Can I go back to the bottom of the largest river in the U.S.? There's been a lot of publicity about certain parts of the state being quote-unquote cancer alley because they're living in proximity to certain petrochemical plants, so on and so forth. I'm not going to put you on the spot to say that is the cause of it, but environmentally, how do you think that factors into these outcomes or the rates of cancer that we have in the state?
I think that living at the bottom of the river and with all of the chemical companies on the river for a long time increases a risk. There are certain communities in Louisiana that have been exposed by groundwater contamination. There's a lot of stories you can read about that. We still have probably the largest asbestos exposure in the country here in South Louisiana. On the West Bank, some oncologists in most of the country might see one or two or three in their career. And in our community, I can see four or five a year. There's a lot of environmental exposure here. And so being at the bottom of the river with all the chemical companies along the way, it's going to concentrate. And I think that some of the ways that they got rid of the toxins weren't the best. Some of that's been cleaned up, but not all of it. And so we still have exposures that way.
Cancer has consistently been near the top of the list for causes of death in the state.
Cancer's up there. I mean, it's up there with heart disease. I mean, it's one of the main causes of death. Cancer can occur in families that have an inherited mutation that increase their risk. And with the work that was done partly at LSU in figuring out the human genome a few years ago, we've opened up a big box, Pandora's box maybe, of mutations that increase your risk for cancer that you can inherit. And then there's also mutations that just occur in the life of a person, in their cells. A mutation will develop that is deleterious or bad and can become cancer. And those situations that occur that way, a lot of times your immune system cleans it up. And so you don't get to the point where you have cancer. But sometimes if your immune system isn't working well for whatever reason, and aging is one of them, then you can't contain it and it becomes an issue.
Would I be correct in saying, I mean, can cancer spontaneously happen in your body for
absolutely.
No reason?
Absolutely. You can just get it. You know, never smoked, never drank, good living, normal body weight, no family history, and all of a sudden you have breast cancer, or prostate cancer, or colon cancer. And it's just a point mutation that happened in a cell that was able to clone or replicate itself and becomes a tumor. And it happens. We see it.
And I think that's what makes cancer so frightening to the general population, because there sometimes is no fault from the person.
Right.
And that can probably add to the frustration. Like, how do you explain that to people when they're like, well, look, I did everything right. I ate well. I didn't smoke. Like, what do you tell them at that point?
Well, we weren't guaranteed that things were going to be fair. And if you do everything right and you have a healthy life, great. You've definitely done everything to reduce your risk of getting cancer, right? But you didn't eliminate it. So it's still a possibility. And, you know, they say, if you live long enough and you're female, you'll get breast cancer. If you live long enough and you're male, you'll get prostate cancer.
That can apply to cancer doctors as well.
So when I was 50, almost 10 years ago now, I started going to get a yearly prostate exam by the urologist. No family history of prostate cancer. Never had a symptom of any sort. No elevation in my PSA, a blood test that they do for screening for prostate cancer. And my exam was always normal. And I went I went every year. I have a family history of colorectal cancer, and so I get colonoscopies on a regular basis. Those have always been clear as well. But in May, when I went for my prostate exam, my PSA was 0.04 of a point above normal. So 4.04. Four would be still in the normal range. And my urologist said, well, you know, why don't you come back in a month? We'll give you some antibiotics. Maybe it's just some infection or inflammation. And I took the antibiotics and I came back a month later, and now it was 4.40. It had gone up. He said, well, we need to do an MRI of your pelvis. And then they could see a tumor in my prostate, a small one, but it was there. And it was sitting on the neurovascular bundle, which is kind of on the edge of the prostate, but it hadn't burst through the capsule or of the prostate. The prostate has like a skin around it that contains it. It was still contained, but it was right up against that area. And let me tell you, that'll sit you down. You know, you recognize that, holy cow, what am I going to do about this?
Dr. Sachs's work with cancer patients goes back to the 1990s. So he spent decades helping people figure out what's the best way to approach their cancer situation. But after getting diagnosed with prostate cancer last May, he didn't quite know what to do, but he knew he was scared.
I think the general fear for people is when they hear cancer, they think, I'm going to die.
Right.
And I hate to ask you this. I mean, did that enter your mind at all?
Oh, yeah. I'm going to die a little bit. I knew it was early. I know prostate cancer is a slow-growing cancer, but most patients don't have the knowledge of cancer that I have. And then functionability. Am I going to be able to control my urine? Am I going to be able to live my regular life? You know, impotency was a concern, but incontinence was actually a bigger weight on me than impotency, because I was just, how can I have this really fun life, really active life, and not be able to control my urine? That really got in my head. And then I was terrified of the side effects of the treatment. Is this going to burn me? All these sorts of things. And, you know, I know a lot about chemo and potions, as I call them, for cancer. I don't know as much about radiation, and I certainly don't know as much about the surgery. So I had to go and talk to people about that. And you're sitting there across the, you know, room from somebody you've worked with for a long time, and it's tearing them up to tell you what's going on with you. You can see it. You can taste it. It's very strange. The whole no control thing, the cancer's in charge, and you have to become in charge by going through the treatment to get to the other side. You got to keep going when you're going through hell.
Obviously, many people know you, and they clearly feel very close to you. What was the reaction when people started hearing? Because word travels fast in a place like Covington that you
people
had cancer.
As soon as they found out I had cancer, so first of all, the word is always whispered. Did you hear Dr. Sachs has cancer? You know, people are afraid to say the word. And then a lot of people who don't know about cancer think all cancer is the same. It's just one cancer and it kills you. But there's tons of different types of cancer, even different types of prostate cancer. And so when they heard I had cancer, a lot of people thought the worst. I heard mumbling of he's probably going to be dead in 3 months and all this sort of stuff. And I got approached, are you okay? And people genuinely concerned for me, and I decided that I needed to put out a note, tell them what's going on. I had, in the first part of it, when I wasn't sure how advanced it was, I had to keep it quiet. My middle daughter's in medical school, and she was getting ready for a big test. And so it was a few weeks of studying to get that test behind her, and I did not want to step on her studying with Dad's got cancer. And so I kept it pretty quiet once I told my kids and my staff. And I told them, I said, yeah, if I was a cardiologist and I had cancer, sure, I can keep it a secret. An oncologist, I'm going to keep the fact that I have cancer for my patients. I feel like that's violating them, because cancer has a stigma associated with it that you feel like you're bad if you have cancer. And so I just put it out there and let them know. And I think that it went well for me that way. I didn't have to hide it. And I felt that anxiety that I've sensed in my patients. And then I go see a friend of mine, a couple of people who are urologists who do the surgery for that, consulted with some radiation doctors, decided, despite the fact that I'm young and healthy and could undergo the surgery, to go with radiation because of the location of the tumor. I thought I would have a less chance of having post-treatment side effects, incontinence, impotency, and that sort of thing. And so I started the radiation. The good news was is that it was early enough that I wasn't going to need to have hormone shots, and I was going to need the radiation, but I could go through a little less than 6-week regimen because of my age and my health. And so I did. They said, you know, you may have some symptoms. You're going to do fine with this. And I did. I did well. I did cut back a little bit at work, just a extra day off a week and stuff like that for a while. And at the end of the treatment on November the 8th, I was exhausted. I mean, fatigue. And I don't get fatigue. I'm the Energizer Bunny. I don't stop. But man, hit the wall. And I had my youngest daughter was getting married in early December. And I thought it was going to be fine. The doctor said, oh, you should be fine. Man, it was all I could do to get to the wedding. And now my strength is back and my fatigue is resolved. But it gave me a different way of looking at things. I mean, I'm pretty empathetic in general, but my empathy level is much higher now because I've walked the path a bit. Thankfully, I've been going for these screening tests. You know, I have a ton of friends who haven't done anything. And I'm thinking, man, you need to go to the doctor. You need to see your primary once a year. You need to get your cancer screening test done and other things like cholesterol and blood pressure and check for diabetes and all these things that help us as a population live longer. We have all these medicines like antibiotics and blood pressure medicine and anti-cancer treatments. And so, but if you don't do the test to find out if you need it, you know, you're not the lucky one that lives to be old.
Cancer screenings and tests, they often require money and health insurance. In Louisiana, it's estimated that more than 360,000 people don't have health insurance. And with more than 18% of the state's population living below the poverty line, there's a lower chance of people getting checkups that may lead to early detection of cancer, even with the expansion of Medicaid that took place in 2017. You heard Dr. Sachs say earlier, there was a point that he was getting tired of oncology. But Dr. Sachs says with the advancements in immunotherapy within the last decade or so, he has seen much better outcomes and a renewed sense of purpose.
And so a lot of what we do now is immunotherapy combined with chemo or some just straight up immunotherapy. The drug itself doesn't kill the cancer. The drug allows your immune system to take care of the cancer.
If you could characterize how you viewed the progression of oncology and cancer treatments since your time in it, how would you characterize that?
We have made giant steps from when I started oncology in the mid-90s. It's becoming more and more specialized, where doctors are going to have to specialize in a disease or maybe a group of drugs because the volume of drugs is becoming so big. We talked about personalized care back when I was in the mid-90s. We actually do it now. We have the ability to test tumors, look at moleculars, and figure out what drugs are going to work the best for this one patient.
As for his prognosis, Dr. Sachs says so far so good. It's been less than a year since his cancer was detected, and just a few months since he underwent treatment for it.
My outlook's good. I have about a 98% cure rate at 15 years. So, you know, 15 years, 75. I'd like to be older than that, but if I can get to 75, I think I'm doing okay. I don't think I'm going to stop working until I'm in my late 60s, early 70s, if I'm healthy and able. It's still interesting work. I like helping people. I don't want to say it's a good thing, but it's kind of a good thing. It kind of got me where I can relate a little bit better than I was before. Sitting down with a patient now, I can feel more what they're feeling, I think. I definitely have, I'm more sensitive to it. I approach things a bit differently. Now that I've been down that road, you know, kind of take notice. Certain things you just don't say. I'm definitely recognizing that I need to take more time and be with my family and go and enjoy things and not just work all the time. You know, I think it's making me a better oncologist.
You don't often hear that getting cancer made someone better at their job. But then again, it's pretty rare that you'll meet someone who's known as the pirate oncologist. But if you do run into him, you'll know.
And getting it from a guy dressed as a pirate or a clown or just in bright clothes,
he's pretty hard to miss. In Covington, I'm Tan Trung for WWL Radio.